All right, do be thinking about questions that you have, both from the talk. Malcolm, yes, we'll have a seat there. Both for the talk that I just gave, anything you'd like to know about that, as well as for what we're going to talk about. In fact, I'm going to open it up so that you can dialogue with the panel as well. First, I'd like to introduce you to our panel members, and we're very appreciative that they were willing to come and join us here at ORSC. Jonathan Band, who is in the second there, sorry, I got them in alphabetical order, is a graduate of Harvard and Yale Law School from 1985 to 2005. He worked at a D.C. law firm 13 years as a partner there. He established his own law firm in 2005. He specialized in database protection, federal and state statutes regarding copyright, international copyright matters. He's written a book called Interfaces on Trial, Intellectual Property and the Interoperability of the Global Software Industry, and many articles. And he represents the ARL, the Association of Research Libraries, here today. June Besick is, as I mentioned, the author of two groundbreaking studies on copyright and under state law as it affects pre-72 recording. She's also the executive director of the Knoshan Center for Law, Media, and the Arts at Columbia. She worked previously for Reuters and was a partner at a law firm in New York, as one of the leading experts on this particular area that we're talking about. Malcolm Grace, who you've seen earlier, is a vice president at Wexler & Walker. Prior to joining Wexler & Walker in 2006, he worked as a counsel in the offices of Congresswoman Linda Sanchez, and before that, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee. So he's well aware of how things work in Washington. He's worked on several Democratic congressional races. He's a graduate of Syracuse, as am I, so go Big Orange. he's been ORSC's representative in Washington, as I mentioned earlier. Gigi Sohn is an internationally known communications lawyer. She co-founded Public Knowledge in 2001. She's quoted frequently in the press, in the New York Times, and the Washington Post, and other publications on copyright matters. She's taught at several universities. I hope you don't mind if I don't read them all. She's a graduate of Boston College and the University. Boston University, pardon me. Boston College at Boston University, yes. and the University of Pennsylvania?
Bosco.
And Corey Williams, I never did get your bio, but would you introduce yourself?
Is this on? I'm Corey Williams. I am Associate Director of the Office of Government Relations here in the American Library Association Washington office. I lobby on copyright and telecom legislation. I was formerly an academic librarian as well as Chief of Staff to the President of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And I have my Master's in Library and Information Science from the University of Iowa.
Thank you. Okay, to get right to it, because I want to give you folks time to respond on some of these issues to us from a perspective that perhaps some of you haven't heard before. There are several issues. I'd like to start by asking you about the current state of intellectual property in legislation in Washington. What are the big issues right now? If you can just make just briefly what you think the big issues are, and what are the non-issues? I mean, just what isn't being dealt with or likely to be dealt with right now? Where is the heat on copyright issues right now? Anyone?
I'm happy to start. First of all, I just want to applaud you guys for getting that thing in the appropriations bill. That's amazing. I mean, for those of you who don't know what Public Knowledge is, we're a public interest advocacy organization. We represent internet users' rights, the public's rights to, you know, have a free flow of information. So we're for balanced copyright laws and an open internet. So we're also very involved in the whole battle over net neutrality. So it's nice to see another group that seems to share a lot of the same principles about copyright terms and what they do to innovation and the sharing of knowledge. So welcome to the scene. But that's fantastic. I mean, I spend a lot of my time, and as John and Corey know, I've spent the last several months fighting little earmarks that Hollywood and the recording industry want to put on to allow ISPs to filter automatically for copyright infringement, which of course is impossible to do. It's impossible to block out the unlawful stuff without blocking out the lawful stuff. So the fact that you got something on is much, much harder to do that than to block something. So my congratulations to you right off the bat. That being said, I don't think the action, at least for the next 6 to 8 months, is going to be in Congress. And part of that is because the Judiciary Committee has to vote on Sonia Sotomayor. Okay, and at least in the Senate, right? So that's where the fight is going to be, at least in the Senate. And the House will do a million things, usually in favor of the copyright owners. But the Senate is not going to be focused on that at all. So I wouldn't expect anything to happen this year. I think the focus really, and Malcolm, I'm going to give you more work to do, is in the courts, because there are two particularly really important court cases you should know about. And I don't want to, I'll talk for just a couple minutes, I'll mention them very quickly. And also in the executive branch, and there's all kinds of appointments that impact on intellectual property policy that have yet to be made, including, most importantly, the so-called IP enforcement coordinator, or more commonly known as IP czar. Okay, this is a position that was in the Department of Commerce, was elevated to the White House by an IP enforcement bill that a lot of us opposed last year but got passed anyway, increased penalties for IP enforcement because we know the penalties are not strong enough, right? So that's a really important appointment, and there's a lot of fighting over it. I know I've been in touch with the White House Personnel Office a lot in the last couple months, people throwing out names. It's either yes or no. I will say the good news is I think the person who will be chosen will have to get buy-in from all different sides. So I don't believe it's going to be, you know, a person who's worked for industry for a long time. It's going to be somebody who's more neutral. So let me just mention the two court cases very, very quickly. First, it has to do with Cablevision and a service they have. It's what's called remote storage, DVR. It's like a TiVo, except instead of having a hard drive in your house, the copy resides in Cablevision servers. Cablevision, for those of you that don't know, is a cable company. Some of the questions, there's a lot of questions involved in that case pertaining to, for instance, whether a buffer copy is a fair use or whether a buffer copy necessitates a license fee that goes to the copyright holder. I mean, that's huge. There are other, again, I could talk about this more, but fair use, except in the buffer copy issue, is not really raised, but it's very, very serious case when it comes to innovation. And the Supreme Court right now is deciding whether to take that case. The second case is the Google Book Search settlement. So I'm going to assume people know what Google Book Search is. Okay, I'm just going to assume it. Come see me later if you don't. Google and the Authors Guild and the publishers have filed a settlement with the court in New York, with the district court in New York, which was to hear the case. And some of us, including some of us on this panel, have very serious concerns about it with regard to privacy, with regard to control over orphan works, because it gives Google and the publishers and the Authors Guild very favorable control over works whose copyright holders they can't find. Now that will also, it could well also impact the orphan works legislation, because were the settlement to be passed, that would mean Google would have special access to orphan works that nobody else would have. So some might argue that would be an incentive for Congress to pass an orphan works.
So those are two big cases.
Yes, two big cases.
That you think will be.
Right. I'm done.
Corey?
I can touch upon, as Gigi mentioned, the Google Book Search proposed settlement is a significant development that impacts, that we're factoring in as we're thinking about the potential or lack thereof for orphan works legislation this year or next or, you know, down the pike. Did want to mention that the American Library Association, along with the Association for College and Research Libraries and the Association for Research Libraries, jointly filed a brief with the judge on May 4th. In response to the proposed settlement announcement, the deadline now for filing is September 4th, I think. And you can see our brief where, as Gigi touched upon, we raise significant issues with concern with regard to price, lack of competition, patron privacy, and intellectual freedom. And our brief, as well as a host of other supporting documents, because the settlement itself is voluminous. It's 146 pages plus multiple, twice that amount for appendices. It's available at wo.ala.org/GBS. And Gigi touched upon orphan works legislation in on the Hill in the short term is not really moving. And there have been a couple of interesting factors also from last session to this that impact the players, so to speak. And I'll just touch upon one. Last year, as we were moving through with orphan works legislation, we had a Senate version of the bill that the library community felt was palatable. I mean, it would benefit us, but wasn't ideal. It passed in the Senate, moved on to the House, where things fell apart. In the House, that bill was being dealt with when the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Courts, Intellectual Property, and the Internet, I think I have the order wrong, but that subcommittee no longer exists this session. So the players are changing. So now orphan works and other IP-related legislation will be dealt with at the full House judiciary level. Since we haven't really had much activity yet this year on IP-related bills, we're not quite sure how that's going to play out. We don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
So you're saying that the Google looks like it's on a fast track. There'll be a lot of action on that, not so much on orphan works.
I think that the court case is going to influence the future of orphan works much more so than we will, legislatively.
You and I know, before I go down to the other end, you wanted to mention something about this?
Right. I just wanted to say a couple of things. One was, as far as the Google settlement goes, I would urge all of you to keep an open mind about it. There's a lot pro and con about this settlement. And in a lot of ways, it would do good things, perhaps not in the best way. And a number of people have said, in theory, they think it's a very good idea if it could be appropriately modified. So it's one of those things that you have to keep in mind. It might not be a good idea to throw out the baby with the bathwater, and it does provide some significant advantages for libraries. I personally don't know how I've come down on it myself, but I do think it's something that requires some serious scrutiny. We had a full-day symposium on it at Columbia in March, and all of the proceedings are up online so that you can listen to them if you like. One of the issues about that is whether it passes muster under antitrust laws, and that's something that the Justice Department is looking at right now. The other thing, I don't know if it's timely or...
Big issues right now.
Right, okay. Then I just want to... The performing rights and sound recordings legislation is also pending. I won't go into the whole detailed discussion of how the law deals with performing rights and sound recordings, but I will say that right now there is an exemption in the law for terrestrial broadcasting, basically for radio stations. And there is an attempt to change that because internet dissemination has different obligations than terrestrial dissemination. So there is a pending bill in Congress to change that, and I don't know exactly where that will go or whether it will be successful or not, but it is there, and it is something that has been tried many times in the past. It probably has more support now than it ever has in the past, but that doesn't mean it will necessarily pass, because it's always easier to stop something than it is to get it passed.
Okay, that's very helpful. John, big issues right now?
Sure, a couple of things. Just building on what others have said, one of the pieces of legislation that is sort of sucking the air out of the IP debate in Congress is the patent legislation. So if we just want to get a sense of the overall landscape, there is this patent bill. It passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee and has sort of stalled there, and it's been introduced in the House, but it hasn't moved there. It is a very controversial bill, and you say, well, what does patents have to do with sound recordings? Well, nothing. But the point is Congress has very limited attention span for things that are not, hot button issues, and surprisingly enough, copyright and and patents and other forms of intellectual property are not those kinds of hot-button partisan issues. And so the result is that they sort of have only the ability to focus on one issue. If they're going to focus on any IP issue, it's kind of one at a time. That's made even worse by the fact, as was mentioned, by eliminating the House IP subcommittee, everything's being handled at the full committee level. So the typical congressional ADD is even worse than it has been in the past. So to the extent they're focusing on IP, it's more on patents than on anything dealing with copyright. Then there is, as June mentioned, there is the performance rights bill. I want to go back to that because that might be an opportunity. The other bill that to the extent there is something that is people are going to be focusing on in Congress and it's considered a must-pass bill, it's the Satellite Home Viewer Reauthorization Act. That's a compulsory license for the satellite broadcasters. I'm going to say, well, what does that have to do with us? Well, it doesn't. But the point is that the compulsory license ends at the end of this year. And if it's not reauthorized, what that means is that, however 30, 40, 50 million Americans who get their television by satellite, they won't be able to watch the bowl games come the beginning of the year, and there are other television broadcasts. That's just unacceptable. That's, we saw before about, things that are un-American, and I mean, what could be more un-American than depriving you of your ability to watch television? And so that is seen as a must-pass bill by the end of the year. So what that does, though, is it presents arguably two opportunities to say, okay, you have your issue. It's going to be very hard, as a pragmatic matter, ever to get, as others have said, it's very hard to get anything passed. And so what you'll ultimately have to do is you're going to have to sort of attach what you want to other things that are moving. And so even though people are saying, well, everyone wants to keep the satellite bill clean, they want to keep a clean bill, it won't be, right? At the end of the day, at the last minute, things are going to get, all kinds of things are going to be stuck onto it.
Has there ever been a clean bill in Washington?
No. It doesn't happen. I mean, and Gigi can tell you about Senator Feinstein and what was it with the Iraq bill? Is that the latest thing
I was talking about how he's trying to stop this filtering stuff. So at first, Senator Feinstein tried to put this filtering amendment onto the stimulus bill, right, as part of the broadband stimulus plan. Then, basically she got found out and killed it, and people are saying Feinstein's anti-net neutrality. I mean, the net roots went crazy. So this time she tried to put on the Iraqi supplemental funding bill. I mean, no shame. Zero shame. And basically we said, we will do the same thing again. And I think that they backed off, and instead they asked a nominee for a commerce position a question about, the use of broadband services for unlawful activities. But they backed off because I didn't think they didn't want
to say
anything.
That's how it works in Washington.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And just the other thing is because you were talking about the RIA before and then the performance rights bills. I mean, the RIA is the big proponent of the performance rights bill. So now I don't know how likely it is to pass this session or even this Congress, meaning this year or next year. There's a lot of opposition, obviously, from the broadcasters who don't want to pay they want to use all the content for free. But that's a bill the RIA wants. And so, again, Washington is all about deals, and that's something to sort of think about. I mean, is there a way to attach
I should mention on that the board, on your behalf, agreed to officially endorse at least the principle of the orphan rights, of the performance rights bill. Why? Because we want to show that we can support them as well, and we're not one-sided on this. And it's nothing that, is Gore's or Ox, certainly. So we've sent letters to the chairs of the judiciary committees on both sides, and we'll send them to the lots of other congressmen and probably to the RIA to show them that we can support something of theirs where we can live with it
I'd caution you just to support it in principle, though, because while I'm all in favor of leveling the playing field and having broadcasters pay the performance rights, what that bill doesn't do is take care of the small webcasters that whose oxes are getting gored. So I just want to give an example. So under this bill, a small broadcaster that makes between $500,000 and $1.25 million in revenues would have to pay $5,000, whereas a webcaster doing the same would have to pay $140,000. Yep. So there's a real disparity there that needs to be fixed.
I don't want to get off track here. It was
well,
for
I
the
think it's on track.
You were correct. It was support for the.
I just want to say on that very issue, I was in a meeting a few weeks ago with counsel for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and they know that's an issue, and that is one of the outstanding things that's being negotiated with that bill.
Right, but I think, and then I'll pass the baton here. But I think the what you need to do, though, before you endorse anything in specific is you need to get paid for it, meaning you don't do anything for free. You need to...
That's a perfect transition, actually.
Yeah. and so you should certainly never support any specific bill unless your provision is in it. You know, you don't give anything away for free.
Thank you. That was an interesting way to transition to me, especially since I assume I'm the one who generated the frown in your PowerPoint presentation, Tim. I'd like, first of all, begin just by saying, just thanking Tim, David Soibert, Sam Berlosky, who I worked with closely on behalf of ARSC last year, and it was just a great experience, and we hope to do that again, particularly... Since Gigi pointed out how incredible the accomplishment of getting the study amendment included in the appropriations bill was, take a second to recognize Stephen Wade, who's out in the audience, who was the primary reason why we were able to accomplish that. His exceptional banjo playing along with Chairman Obi is the reason why we were able to accomplish that.
So.
Yeah, well, he is the primary reason why we were able to accomplish that. So I just wanted to recognize Stephen and thank him for all his hard work on that. Just a couple of things. I think all of the comments by the members of the panel have been right on point. I do think as well that the performance rights bill is going to be the primary thing that is at least keeping the attention of the House Judiciary Committee for the next couple of weeks and anything related to intellectual property. Just, you know, small rumors that I've heard recently is that Conyers is still very much trying to push this bill through and force negotiations. So as everyone is on the panel has already said, you know, they sort of have a one-track mind on things. Once they sort of get something in their sights, they focus on that. So there's not likely to be a whole lot of action on other copyright issues in the near term. I do think, though, that ARSC has done a good job of trying to remain engaged. I mean, our rationale, I think, for at least commenting on the performance rights bill and trying to show some support for what they're trying to do up there was twofold. I mean, in addition to sending them some credit for moving on the performance rights bill, we also once again let them know what ARSC's priorities are. We once again raised the issue of Section 301C, how that's detrimental to historic sound recordings, and just kept ourselves very much on their radar screen, which is going to be important if and when Orphan Works comes up and down the line as more opportunities come to have an influence on shaping copyright policy.
Okay, thank you. One thing I would mention that I learned from Malcolm last year was that while Congress generally moves very slowly on these things, and it takes years to fight them through, legally, they can, and occasionally do a markup on 24 hours' notice. I believe that's what it is.
They can, yeah. It can come up relatively quickly. I mean, generally, I mean, there'll be some awareness or, you know, leaks that something's coming down the pike, but, you know, a markup can appear, you know, pretty rapidly. But on a major piece of legislation, there's generally awareness that it's
well,
coming.
The point is, if you're not watching carefully all the time, I think everybody here is nodding. Things can slip by you. I think our provisions slipped by some people, frankly. In that case, it was good. but in other cases, it cannot be good. So you need to be watching this ball closely lest somebody else slip something by on you. Well, one thing I did not hear from anyone on the panel here was that it looks like this is the year for orphan works, or it looks like finally Section 108 preservation is going to come up. I'm not hearing our issues directly. I'd like you to address, if you could, a little bit about what the prospects are for those two things which directly affect our members. Anybody?
I can speak to that.
Sure, Jim.
A couple things. One is, I actually wouldn't be surprised to see orphan works come up. I don't think the fact that it hasn't been reintroduced means that it won't come up in the next couple years. I think that we were very close last year, and a lot of people were reluctantly acquiescent in the bill as it ended up in the as it was passed in the Senate. So we'll see what happens on that. The major issue is whether there will be a notice of use that you're required to file. I won't go into that into detail, but I think that ultimately could be worked out. On 108, that's a subject that's near and dear to my heart since I spent 3 years on the Section 108 group. And I would say right now there is no immediate prospect. It's with the Copyright Office, and they're supposed to be doing a study, and I think it's probably not the highest priority. I think, and I think some of my colleagues here could probably respond to this better than I, but that in large part, the libraries may believe that they're simply better off relying on the fair use doctrine than in getting changes to Section 108. So, or it may just be that their legislative priorities are different because everybody picks the things that they want to resolve.
Wasn't the 108 report issued last year?
Oh, the 108 report was issued in March of 2008. Because
it
was always the envisioned that the Copyright Office, the 108 group made recommendations for how they thought that legislation might work. There were a number of open issues, but the idea was the Copyright Office would then take it, do a study, and have public comment and come forth with actual legislative recommendations as it did in the case of the Orphan Works Bill, where they actually formulated.
So it's in their court now.
It is in their court because fundamentally the 108 group wasn't going to be able to work out everything. There were some things where we were able to agree on high-level recommendations but not on more of the details. And those details do have to be worked out if there's going to be an actual legislative proposal. Okay. So it'll be with the Copyright Office.
Got it. Corey?
Yeah, to reemphasize what June is saying, the Copyright Office has identified that this year is an exploratory investigative year with regard to 108, that they're likely, you know, not necessarily any action, but they're thinking and looking into it and studying it. With regard to the library community, I can speak on behalf of ALA and our members. There is that sense, June, that there were some high-level high-level points upon which the committee or the group could come to agreement, but that there are still many issues outstanding, and there's some hesitation to open it up without having a sense of what we really want to ask for, because we could be opening Pandora's box. So there's the sense that we need to figure out exactly what do we want from Section 108 before we open it.
Okay.
Can I just I just want to fill in some gaps on the orphan works, because RIA actually, as you mentioned, is supportive. The folks that are not so supportive and have really gone a whole 180 on the Orphan Works issue is the MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America. For obvious reasons, they need Orphan Works relief, right? They're going to be Orphan Works users far more than they're going to be Orphan Work, you know, somebody be using their works. They don't have any Orphan Works. But they decided literally at the last minute, I think the Senate bill was palatable to a lot of people. And I'll tell you, I was canvassing for Mr. Obama in Winchester, Virginia, begging Mr. Berman, who had control over the Orphan Works Bill, to put the Senate bill on, you know, on a fast track, basically, to get it passed. And he wouldn't do it. And it was because MPAA decided that they wanted to reopen the whole issue of injunctive relief. So whether somebody who underwent a good faith search and couldn't find a copyright holder and used the work should be subject to getting an injunction in court. And for some odd reason, the Motion Picture Association did a total 180 and wanted to and changed its position. So in my opinion, it wasn't the million. Congress wasn't listening really to the graphic designers and the drape makers. I mean, they made a lot of noise, but they really weren't serious players. But the MPA decided at the last minute to change its mind. I don't know why. I have my conspiracy theories. But that is, in my opinion, is really what killed the bill.
Okay. And just to amplify the conspiracy theories then, is that And this is something sort of just the general atmospherics, and this builds on what Tim mentioned, but also others have said before, is that there is the copyright industries have done a very good job over the past 20 years convincing Congress that more is always better, and then overlaying that very steady, consistent effort that they've made is the internet and Napster and the drop in sales at the of sound recordings, even though there's many reasons why, you know, probably internet infringement is one, but only one of many other reasons why record sales are down. But regardless, the general attitude of the content providers and therefore of their friends in Congress, and again, they've been very good at cultivating friends for a very long period, is no, meaning no to any exceptions, no to any limitations, no to anything that moves the ball one inch towards users as a matter of principle. And so you know, that's a reality that's, you know, that's you know, welcome to Washington. I mean, that is a reality we have to deal with, and that's why anything, you know, your best chances are always going to be, you know, sort of getting yourself attached to something they want rather than something they don't want. Now, Orphan Works, the good news to some extent is that is something that the publishers really affirmatively want, and that's why it went as far as it went. It wasn't just, you know, the libraries and the museums and the cultural institutions pushing for it, but it was also the publishers. You know, they wanted it too. And so that gave it sort of, was able to sort of get past this general aversion to exceptions. But I think then at the end of the day, the, you know, the MPA sort of the just say no.
Right. Could I move this on? Because June is bursting with a comment on that. You can see, by the way, between our five experts, there are sometimes nuances of differences too. But June?
I just want to say this because I say this to my students every year, and I feel compelled to say it here, which is it's easy in a field as polarized as copyright sometimes is to demonize one side or the other. And you've heard sometimes, you know, people talk about Hollywood and the big copyright industries and stuff like that. On one side, there is Hollywood and the big copyright industries. There are also individual copyright owners, creators, authors. On the other side, yes, there are individual users, but there are also large service providers, large equipment, end user, you know, a playback equipment and things like that. So all I'm saying is there are big players on both sides, there are individuals on both sides, and you have to keep that in mind because it's always easy to make it look like, oh, well, there's big industry against the little user. That's just not always the case, and that goes both ways. So you just really have to keep that in mind as you consider these debates.
Okay. I'd like to move on to the Copyright Office study. This is going to be of specific interest and something we need to be involved in as ARSC, I think, for the next 2 years when they study this. I'd like to ask the panelists what they think ARSC should do. Now that this window is open for comment and so forth, what tact would you recommend for us, understanding what our goals are, which I think most of you seem to share, at least generally in principle? If you can comment on that briefly, please. Anyone?
Lawyers.
Briefly, well, right. Well, yeah, right, because we do build
moderators
by...
Moderators are always...
Right,
drivers,
we do so. Build by the hour, so we...
I'm a librarian, not a lawyer.
I would say there's two things. One is you really need to gather all as much internal evidence as you can, and so that when the request for comments comes out, that not only does the association file, but that all of your individual institutions file and you file. I mean, you want to sort of swamp the office with paper and with concrete examples. You know, be very, very, very specific. The other thing is, in addition to doing that, you know, really building the best factual case and collecting all the evidence and having, again, many voices, not just the one comment of the association. The other thing is make sure you keep on talking to the RIAA and to songwriters and to individual performers. You know, you want to have them weigh in as positively as possible, too, because, again, nothing's going to happen if it's just you wanting it. It's got to be, you know, there's going to be concern, you know, what is the influence going to be on, what's the impact going to be on the performers? And so you need to have as many individual performers or whatever, as many performers weigh in that this is something they want, too.
That's very helpful. Others? Yes.
Following up on Jonathan's first point with regard to reaching out to your members to cultivate support and get everyone engaged and around this issue, while this, you know, the study will, you know, as the Copyright Office is working to engage, you know, start the study, it's a great time for you to engage in grassroots advocacy, and you can use this case as an example to educate your members and other members. You know, for example, representatives from your group and the Music Library Association come to the ALA's conference, and they come to my copyright subcommittee and brief us on these issues and educate us. Reach out and build some understanding and advocacy around copyright generally with regard to sound recordings. It's a perfect grassroots opportunity to educate on copyright in general. What is it? Why do we care? And it's a good case study because it's interesting, and you have a real success story here, and you can potentially, if you're all geared up and you've got concrete examples of pulling out a sound recording that you can show, you know, your the Copyright Office and also your representatives at home, you know, congresspersons out in the field, what you're talking about tangibly, that gets them more on board.
Malcolm.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. And just sort of anecdotally, going back to 2008 when we were first going up to the Hill and talking to the members of the House Judiciary Committee, the IP subcommittee about ARSC and about Section 301C, it was basically an issue that was new to even the most senior intellectual property staffers on the IP subcommittee. It was just an issue that they had never heard about. They had never considered. There was maybe two sentences of it in the Copyright Office's Orphan Works in their Orphan Works report, but basically dismissing historic sound recordings as being in the category of Orphan Works. And this study is going to be an exceptional opportunity for you all to educate members of Congress, those folks who are going to be shaping copyright policy in the future, and to lay out, you know, your arguments very, very clear and shape how their thinking progresses in the future.
I would only add that it's not just a legal and lobbying strategy, it's also a PR strategy. You tell your stories. You have people who blog, you know, talk to the Netroots about blogging about it. I mean, definitely make friends. I mean, the fact that, I know Malcolm, I knew you represented something having to do with recording archivists, but I didn't know you represented this organization. And when I was asked to speak, I was like, who are these people? And you probably don't know who the hell I am, so let's make friends. I mean, that's serious. So that's number one. Number two is you got to start to tell your stories and start to publicize this. This is, it's not minor to you, but in the grand scheme of copyright law, when we're talking about filtering and, you know, term extension, this is little. This is a no-brainer, right? And that's your message. No-brainer. Gore's nobody's ox. Obviously, you have to make the factual case, but you've got to do the PR. And I'm not saying you have to go, you know, spend a lot of money on some expensive firm like Wexler and Walker. Just kidding. To do your PR.
The retainer that we charged ARSC was the lowest in the firm. But it was still very high, and I can admit that.
I'm talking about a PR firm, but in any event, it's easy to do PR these days. So, and you've got people like Dick Spotswood, right? You have a show, right? Talk about it on your show. I'm not kidding.
I want to talk real quick. I agree completely about the examples. Those are incredibly persuasive. I think wild hyperbole is not very useful, and nor is free-floating anxiety. So you really need to say why. And a few really good examples, and think about those examples and make sure they're ones that aren't easily refuted, and those will go a long way. Facts mean everything, but that doesn't mean you can't distill them in the most persuasive way. People have limited attention spans in this age of the internet, although my 15-year-old assures me that's not the case. But I think that, you know, executive summaries and short summaries of what you're trying to do, followed up by the backup material, is really useful. Finally, it's easy to sit here and say that it's a no-brainer, and maybe it is. I think it depends. As I look at all the goals, I think some are more no-brainers than others. It's important to understand why others might be opposed. Most people here have a particular perspective, but I think actually are relatively knowledgeable and understand what the other perspectives might be, and you have to keep that in mind as well. You are better prepared if you understand why people might oppose. And some of that may be free-floating anxiety. That's true, they're opposition. But there actually may be some reasonable reasons why someone might be opposed. And you need to find out about those so you're prepared.
Okay.
And just in line with that, obviously, beautiful. You know, there's a, you know, getting back to your initial proposals of five, I mean, you know, there's even a degree of granularity. I think when you're pushing things like preservation, I can't imagine anyone really opposing that. Even the most vociferous rights holder, I think, you know, once you indicate you're not flushing his state copyright law down the toilet, I think certain things like that are a whole lot easier. And whereas, you know, posting it on the internet is obviously going to be more problematic, and it's going to get more people riled up, and they will feel that is having more conceivably more of an impact on their rights. So you know, you need to, you know, when you need to be obviously very concrete, very specific, and recognize and have it even when you're giving your example, you know, break it down, make it clear what the alternatives are and the different things you're talking about, because some will be much easier sells than others.
Okay, two other things I want to get to real briefly here, and then I want to open it to questions. The first one is very practical, down-to-earth kind of thing, and some of you may want to speak to this and others don't have to. And that is, we have a lot of individual members here. They're all, almost all of them, I think, voters in the United States, unless there are any felons out there. Which there may be under copyright law, I suppose.
Anybody use peer-to-peer?
How do you... First of all, is there any value in approaching your congressman individually? I'm a voter in your district, et cetera. And if so, how do you do that? What's the way to get through? Email? Send them a letter? Do you have to barge into their office? How do you, as citizens and voters, how do you help move this issue? Or can you?
Visit them in their district.
Yep.
District visits.
And also, when you're talking about providing concrete examples, get them to come to you. Invite them to your institution or library and whatnot and show them physically and let them listen in here and say, we can't preserve this. In 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, this might have deteriorated and you'll have lost it forever. You won't be able to come back and listen to this. And so make it tangible and interesting, hands-on. You know, make them do a field trip.
Great. Anybody else on how to do that? The last thing I want to ask about is a case that June brought to my attention, the Golan case, which you indicated was of importance to us to understand something about because it's beginning to have,
Yeah, I think it's something that you ought to be aware of. I think most people here are aware of the Eldred case, which upheld the copyright term extension. The Golan case, which was Golan against Gonzalez, now it's Golan against Holder, challenged the copyright restoration provisions. Those provisions were to put the U.S. in compliance with international treaty obligations, and it brought back out of the public domain into copyright certain works by foreign right holders that had gone into public domain because they didn't comply with the formalities, but also a number of foreign sound recordings. The challenge was on constitutional grounds, and the court basically threw out the copyright clause challenge, but the Circuit Court of Appeals sent back the case to the district court on the First Amendment challenge, and the district court decision was issued in the last couple of months. And the district court basically held that although there was a valid governmental purpose, the act was broader than was needed to protect that governmental purpose. So basically, those copyright restoration provisions are have been undermined on constitutional grounds. Now, I don't know. That will go back up to the Tenth Circuit, and then there might be an attempt to fix this by legislation, because I don't think the court said it was impossible to restore copyright, but basically they were concerned that not enough effort had been made to protect those who were relying on works that they thought were in the public domain and could no longer use them. So that's a case definitely to watch. It's Golan against Holder.
If I could just add on that, I mean, I completely agree with June on that. That's an important case, but I think what it signals is a more important argument that you really have out there, and that is that there is this growing. And Golan is an example of that, but even there was language in the Elder decision, which really talks about that there are First Amendment limits on copyright that people didn't really recognize or focus on before. Now, where that comes to pass is it seems to me that you have a very good argument that certainly if you want to make a preservation copy, that you would have, I think you could probably make a First Amendment challenge to any state copyright common law principle that would limit that. Okay, I think, in other words, I think the First Amendment, especially the growing jurisprudence about the relationship between the intellectual property clause and the First Amendment, and also this recognition of the importance of the First Amendment in this area, I think that that's an argument that could be used with respect to state copyright law. Now, this is a very, very, you know, we're very early stages of this, but I think it's an important idea to keep in mind, and it wouldn't make, and it might even be worth, trying to get some law professors interested in sort of thinking about that, and maybe some already have talked about that. But that we're not only is that a good argument on its own, if in the event you ever go to litigation to say, well, the preservation effort I'm making is First Amendment protected, notwithstanding the state common law. But I think it also can help in the legislative argument. In other words, you can say, hey, we have, you know, there's this constitutional right out here, but we, you know, Congress, what we want you to do is, in essence, sort of codify that or put some clarity and some bounds. And I could see right holders saying, you know what, rather than have them push this First Amendment thing, because, you know, that might go way further than they want, they might say, well, yeah, a statutory solution might be better. So there is this could be part of your legislative strategy.
Speaking of law professors thinking about that, too.
I just wanted to mention one more case, which I think is really important, because you mentioned earlier about common law being absolute, and that's getting chipped away somewhat, too. There was an important case, which you may have heard of, called EMI Records against Premise Media, and it has to do with John Lennon's song Imagine and its use in a documentary that has to do with religion and science. And in fact, that is a pre-72 sound recording. It was recorded in 1971. And the court in New York, and this is a common law case, said, we're going to apply the fair use doctrine, that it's not absolute, and we think that we should apply fair use in this case, and we think that it is a fair use. And I mention that because I think a number of the kinds of things that you guys would be doing in terms of preservation would fall under, you know, a fair use analysis. So, you know, it's a beginning, it's not the end, but at least it's a hopeful development in terms of state law.
Okay, thank you. Now, I want to give the audience a chance here. There are other questions I can ask, but I want to give you your chance to ask either about the presentation or to our esteemed panel here. Let me start right here. Yes. Yeah. There's a mic here.
Mike. Thanks. Harmonization is a big deal in Brussels. How big a deal is it, and how dangerous it is to efforts here to secure a larger portion of the public domain?
Anyone? June?
You made an argument earlier that we should be like Europe and have a 50-year term. If they extend their term, then that argument is somewhat undermined. But in fact, one of the things I think we all have to keep in mind, it is they have a different regime for protection of sound recordings. And also to some degree for protection of the underlying musical works. It's not the same. So I don't think their lengthening the term would in any way prompt us to do any lengthening, but it could inhibit any ability to shorten the term, although that seems to me, I think that shortening the term is it would be a very difficult road to hoe if the RIAA were opposed to it, as I would guess that they would be.
If I could just interject here before we go to John, where they seem to be going in Europe is to a 70-year term, because they can't get 95, which would be nice for us to have, actually, but also quite possibly with a use it or lose it for the last 20 years there, too. There's a big fight over that. That would be wonderful if we had it, too, because that means things would be available for the first time, and if they weren't available, they would be public domain. So it's almost inconceivable to me that anything that Europe would do would be worse than what we have. Almost anything they do would be better than we do, even if they extend things over there the way they're fighting about it now.
I think harmonization is always a nice argument. It's a helpful argument. It's not the winning argument. So, you know, in your bullet point, you know, maybe it's on the, you know, at the bottom of the page or the second to the bottom, because it's nice, but it's not going to win the day on its own, certainly. And I think the other thing to remember always, and again, this is a terrible thing to recognize, but at the end of the day, this is never about the merits. I mean, we're in Washington. It's about it's about the politics. And so you have to, it's nice, it's good to have all of them, the right arguments and the strong arguments, but you always have to remember the politics, and that goes back to the points that Gigi and Corey were making about the contacts and the district, and nothing makes a congressman happier than, you know, to have his picture taken in the local whatever, so the local library, whatever. I mean, and those are opportunities that we miss far too often. I mean, they love doing that kind of thing. I mean, they need to get elected or reelected, and showing interest in what's going on in their districts is critical to
wise
them.
Words from somebody who knows how they sausage
I just think
made.
Harmonization is often used more to lengthen copyright terms than it is to shorten them. And also, you know, policy laundering, that is, you know, we didn't get the DMCA passed here originally, okay? Content industry went overseas, got it overseas, and then came back. So that's another danger, and that sort of falls in the same camp as harmonization.
Okay, Mike Beal.
I want to go to something a little bit more basic in the Constitution. Forget the Bill of Rights. Going back to go back to what established the patent and copyright law in the Constitution. In order to promote the fine and industrial arts, Congress shall pass regulations to grant creators for a limited period of time, exclusive rights. My reading of the Constitution is, you go back to the 1700s now, what they're trying to do is make the United States industrial and artistic like the home country was. Now, what they're looking for is a way to jumpstart industrial and creative arts by giving the people who do the creation rights for a limited period of time, and then it goes into the public domain.
Your question, Mike?
My reading of, this is it. My reading of the Constitution is the public domain is more important to promote the fine industrial arts than that limited period of time. In other words, my idea is that the framers of the Constitution said the public domain is what was important.
Thank you. Anyone want to comment on that? That's just more statement than. Okay. Next. Good statement.
I'd like to know.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be dismissive.
Just to respond, I mean, I think the issue here, though, is that we're dealing with state that's the federal constitution, and we're dealing with state common law. And then there is an act. There's always the issue about preemption. And now obviously, in the 1976 Copyright Act, they said that they were not preempting state common law with respect to the sound recordings, the pre-72 sound recordings. However, there is an argument that could be made, and that the IP clause of the Constitution should preempt this perpetual state protection. I think that is a not unreasonable argument, and that again, you know, with sort of the rediscovery of the Constitution and the constitutional bases and here, I think that there might be something there that it is fundamentally inconsistent with the constitutional structure to have this area of perpetual state copyright. That there is a constitutional preemption. I think that there's.
Do you wanted to add to that?
I wanted to add a couple of real quick things. In theory, I think you are right, but if you look at how the Eldred case was discussed, the court put a lot of emphasis on what the experience under the law has been, and having gone on now for more than 200 years with this dual system, I think it would be overly optimistic to think that. The court would say, now it's unconstitutional. The other point I just wanted to address briefly is the constitutional clause is to promote the progress of science and useful arts. Science meant learning or knowledge. So it's not just the public domain, although that is a part of it, but I think in general we believe that even the works that are under copyright can contribute to science, to knowledge and learning during the term of copyright, because they are often disseminated and made available, you know, textbooks, reference works, a whole other thing. So it operates on a number of different levels.
Also, the other thing is, it's not Congress shall, it's Congress may. All right? Congress doesn't have to, it doesn't need to be copyright and patent law. Shall have the power, but that's different than saying they shall enact laws.
Well, the public domain starts immediately. If they didn't pass the laws, then public domain would be the only thing that we would have.
Okay, can we go on to our next question?
Okay.
Yes.
I'm Frank Borman. You would know me from my discographies in the Journal of the Mravinsky and Acoustic Chamber Music Sets. The piece of news is that some of those Bowen archives that won't let...
Could you get a little closer to the microphone, please?
The number of Bowen archives that would not allow access to U.S. IP addresses, you can still get them if you can manipulate the Google cache. It's tricky. In the upper world, the real world, I'm an economist, and I'd like to note that there are no economists among the 500 staff at the Office of Copyright. My question is, what is the value of all these pre-1972 recordings? It would seem that it's slight. The EMI 100 or 200 CD set of great recordings of the century should have been called great recordings of the half century, because there were just one or two of them that were before that. Another telltale is that the companies are not doing a very good job of preserving their own archives. I mean, books, it's trivial to preserve a book, but these archives are much more expensive. They're not worth it. Now, my idea is that the copyright holders, after 20 years, pay $500 every 5 years to keep something in copyright. So the things that are in copyright and that are in print, you can get it. You just buy them. There will be a few works that a publisher speculates that might come back in. That is, if he's willing to shell out $500 for every 5 years to protect it. There are books, and of course these old sound recordings that do come back into print. But it's speculation. Everything else, if he's not going to shell out the $500 every 5 years, it goes into public domain.
Okay.
But what I would like to know is, Does anybody know how often, you know, books remain in print more than 20 years? How many books come back into print after they've gone out of print, rather than they sell under degenerate very little profits? And for the pre-1972 recordings that are reissued, does anybody have any numbers, sales statistics in this by the majors?
Let us address that. Let us address that.
So I want to know something about the value of all this stuff. I asked the panel.
Is there anyone on the panel who would like to?
I'm going to be writing this up. I'll be communicating in the ARC list on the subject. But I need some facts.
Just two quick responses. One, with respect to the issue, the idea of sort of some kind of copyright renewal. Of course, we used to have that system where you had an initial term and then you renewed it for another term. It was originally 14 and 14 and then 28, 28. Now we've moved away from that system, and because of our adherence to the Berne Convention, those kinds of formalities would be very, very problematic. So it's a good idea, but I think the time has passed it by. With respect to the idea of really focusing on the numbers, I mean, that I think is critical, and it really would be very helpful, and I don't know if, unfortunately, I don't know how much... In the Copyright Office process, how much access you will have to those numbers, but it'll be of course extremely interesting to know how many pre-1972 records are sold, and if it turns out that we're really talking about at the end of the day, you know, these trivial sales, that's important. Now it's going to be very hard. I assume it will be very hard to get those numbers to be able to. Be able to show that we're really talking about, you know, a handful of people who have any kind of demonstrable sales, but on the other hand, you know, it could be, you know, if we're talking about John Lennon, you know, then it could be that we're talking about at least a hand, you know, some artists having enormous sales, and so, but it would be very helpful to know, you know, to get those numbers. I mean, that's a lot of people have always talked about how in copyright we have sort of faith-based intellectual property, that it's all sort of based on this belief, but that there's very that more is always better, but there isn't a lot of hard evidence, and so the more hard evidence we have, obviously, the better.
Anyone else want to do that directly? That kind of leads Steve Smolian and I. The study we did was the first attempt at trying to put some numbers against what, in fact, is available there. And you're right; anything that could take that forward to actual dollars, which they did in Europe, to some effect, actually, would be helpful. Steve,
We are neophytes in the engaging with the legal system, which this is in broad and narrow terms. And this organization proudly has engaged a very capable person to help us do that. And my question is, can we hear from you as to what we can do to make your job easier and make this then a more effective engagement between us?
Between Tim, David, and Sam, who are here, the first thing that we started doing last year was building the larger coalition. Last year it was just ARSC that was going in and speaking on the issues of Section 301C. And the process of building a larger coalition and having sort of a strength in numbers approach as we go to Capitol Hill has been good. The comments that have already been made that it's important to engage members of Congress in their districts personally, I think, is another part of it. I think the most important thing, and I've made this point a few times before, is to stay engaged and stay vocal on your issues as frequently and as often as you possibly can. Certainly, if you can make those points as related to a particular bill that's moving, that's great. But one of the biggest challenges that You know, when I was a few years ago a congressional staffer and even now out in the private sector, is when you sort of come in and you want to make an ask of a member of Congress in the 11th hour after a bill has been baking or some policy objective has been moving for several years, and you're sort of a Johnny-come-lately to the effort, it makes it that much more difficult for you to have credibility. However, this room and ARSC, you are the leading experts on historic recordings and preservation of and access to historic recordings. And you can use that expertise to talk to members of Congress, offer them your perspective on things, as appropriate, weigh in on certain bills. We can debate the merits of supporting bills or not, but weighing in on certain bills and offering your perspective and your expertise develops a sense of goodwill, a reputation amongst the members of Congress, and that will help you going forward when you have specific objectives that you want to accomplish in terms, whether it's 301C or any of the other five copyright reforms that you'd like to see enacted.
In that regard, is there some way, because I know this won't be in the congressional directory, that you can find out for us, or somebody you know can find out for us, what the musical interests are of each of the congressmen? I'm serious about this. I've seen it work. So that we can find out which ox they'd be most responsive to knowing is being gored.
No, that is very, very smart point, and that is something that we've actually done. One of the first members that we went and talked to was John Conyers, who is well known for his love of jazz music. We went and had a particularly pointed conversation with a new member of the Judiciary Committee last year, Stephen Cohen, who's based in Memphis, which has a very rich music industry there. He has pictures all over his wall of him with Elvis Presley and Bo Diddley and other folks like that. So we really tried to use every hook that we could. Yes, I can, but it will take some digging. But I can get that to David and Tim and Sam for you.
Or you could, in each of your districts, you know, task someone with finding that out. That's a great way. You know, call up the staffer and say, you know, we're thinking we'd like to invite, you know, Congressperson X or Y. And by the way, you know, ask them. They're people. They're individual. You know, they're just like you and me. They're no different.
Eminent reissue producer Chris Starkwitz.
Thank you. It's all been very interesting. I'm not sure how many are here who actually have record companies, because I'm going to try to play the devil's advocate here, because I think the issue should come up. And, of course, I'm all for getting all the material that exists in these vaults eventually out there. And I think we've got to realize that it's almost the record companies as such have finished selling goods, like a CD or something. It is now basically involving downloads, whether legal or illegal, as well as sort of this huge iPod that the internet thing, you know, where you can buy things legally. I would just suggest that this use it or lose it thing is really an important part, because for small record labels like us, for example, we do depend on mostly downloads now that are a source of income for us, as well as the use of masters in films. And you can never really predict what people suddenly want to license. And so it's really hard to say, well, all this stuff should be in the public domain, because we have an obligation to the artists who created these things. For example, if we bought an old line of records like the EDR label, which I did, whenever we license one of those masters to a film company, which happened in the case of Paulina Bernal, we split the fees with the artists. We feel that's a fair way to do it. And I'm not sure, but putting all this in the public domain is really the solution. I think we should put much more emphasis on lose it or use it. So if a company is actively has this material online or on any source, like the Smithsonian, I think, is having everything they have ever recorded is available. If you want to order a CD, they'll make you one. But I think it's, I don't know, I just want to make those comments about that it costs a good deal of money to maintain an archive. you know, you have to be a good steward of this material, and that's not cheap. It takes space to house this stuff and so on. So I think there's two sides to all this, you know.
Okay. Unfortunately, that's the last time of a question.
I don't think there's any debate about putting anything in the everything in the public domain. It's not going to happen. And as John said, there are real, and June said, there are real problems with even shortening copyright terms, even though I think there's universal agreement, even among policymakers who voted for the last copyright term extension, that wasn't a good idea. But rolling back the clock is not, that's not a part of
the debate. What's your feeling about use it or lose it? What are the prospects?
I think that's what Orphan Works in some ways is about, right? It's like if you're not making yourself known as a copyright holder, you don't really lose it, though, okay? Because if you find out that somebody is using it, you still get paid reasonable compensation. And that's where the $1 million against Orphan Works and the toilet bowl are crazy. They don't know what the hell they're talking about, because you don't lose it, you know, if you find that somebody's using your work. But I like that concept. I think that's it's more sympathetic than saying throw everything in the public domain.
Anybody else on use it or lose it and the prospects in the U.S. for something like that?
I have to say, I think that would be somewhat problematic, because traditionally we've had the sense that you as a copyright owner can decide whether or not to make your work available. That is, I think the distinction you made with Orphan Works is a very valuable one, because that's a situation where you really can't find the person. Or you don't know who it is at all, or you know who it is and you can't find them. But it would be a significant departure from our law to say that you are compelled to make your work available, which is really what we would be saying. It's easier to do that kind of thing when you are giving something additional, as they are doing in the EU. They're adding on the terms. So if the alternative is to give people nothing, but if we're going to give it to you, we're going to say you have to use it. But to cut back and make it use it or lose it, I think would be more problematic.
Anybody else on use it or lose it? The prospects? No. Well, I want to thank our panel. I'm sorry, we're out of time here. I know you have a break. Some of the panelists may be around. I want to give them a big round of applause.